Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyau from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
I'm Michael Isikoff, and this is Spy Talk.
On August 15th, 1953, an armored caravan weaved through the streets of Tehran. Inside the lead car, the commander of the Iranian Imperial Guard carried a decree from the Shah, officially dismissing the country's prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, from office. The military action culminated months of secret planning by British and American intelligence agencies as part of a plot to overthrow the Iranian government.
That's an excerpt from a PBS documentary from a few years ago about one of the most contentious episodes in the history of the CIA, the 1953 coup that overthrew the government of Iran's elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, and solidified the autocratic rule of the country's monarch known as the Shah. It was a covert operation done in coordination with British intelligence that was improved in broad strokes by President Dwight Eisenhower to counter what U.S. officials feared, with equivocal intelligence at best, that Iran might fall into the Soviet orbit. But the actual seedy details of the operation, classified for years, were carried out by a collection of CIA warriors who stirred up popular dissent, bribed opposition leaders, bankrolled protesters to march on the streets, and paid off street thugs to attack religious clerics, a ploy whose purpose was to make it look like it was being done by Mossadegh supporters and not paid operatives of American intelligence. Overseeing the whole operation was Frank Wisner, one of the legendary pioneers of the CIA, a brilliant but troubled man who orchestrated the agency's covert ops for more than a decade during the height of the Cold War. Doug Waller, a veteran U.S. national security reporter, has written a new book, The Determined Spy, that examines Wisner's controversial career and the complicated legacy he left behind, one that continues to reverberate to this day. We'll talk to Waller about Wisner's fascinating life story, including his descent into mental illness, on this episode of Spy Talk. Doug Waller, welcome to Spy Talk. Want to congratulate you on the book, The Determined Spy, a massive work of research by you about the storied and controversial career of Frank Wisner, one of the pioneers of the CIA. Tell us about Frank Wisner, who he was, and what prompted you to want to write his biography.
Wisner in the 1950s was one of the most powerful CIA men in Washington, although few people in the city had the security clearance to realize that that was the case. I really got first interested in him two books ago. I wrote a biography of General William Wild Bill Donovan, who was head of Franklin Roosevelt's spy service called the Office of Strategic Services. And I ran across Wisner's name there among the many operatives who worked for Donovan, thought, oh, this is an interesting guy. And I filed him away in my future story file, as most journalists have, thinking, well, I'll get back to him one day. The next book, and I guess what you'd call a trilogy, was a book titled The Disciples, which was an ensemble biography of four men who worked under Donovan, who later became CIA directors. That's Alan Dulles, Richard Helms, Bill Colby, and Bill Casey. I ran across Wisner's name once more, particularly when he was working for Alan Dulles, who headed up the OSS's very large spy mission in occupied Germany after the war. And I thought, you know, again, this looks like an interesting guy. And I eventually decided, well, I'd write a biography of him. I first actually talked to his oldest son, Ambassador Frank Wisner II, who was a prominent American diplomat in his own right.
Ambassador to India, I believe.
Yeah, no, he had a number of top.
Was that under Clinton? He was ambassador to India.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. His Wisner's three sons, all agreed to cooperate in terms of interviews and everything. And I think I probably interviewed them about 50 hours. And we had to go over some tough subjects, as we'll get into later. Wisner was a very controversial character. And he had what turned out to be a fatal brain disease, bipolar disorder.
Right. But I mean, the main thing is he was so instrumental in the Cold War shadow wars that we fought with the Soviets for years. And he oversaw all those covert operations, many of which did not succeed, and we'll get into that.
Yeah.
But he starts out as an officer of the legendary OSS during World War II, where he spends time in Romania to stir up opposition to the Nazis. But he also leads, by the way, I should add, to a sexual indiscretion that would haunt him for years and put FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover on his tail. So tell us about his OSS days and his time in Romania and the indiscretion that would hang over him for throughout his career.
Well, you have to go back. 1909 is when he was born. He was a son of the South. His father was a prominent lumberman in Laurel, Mississippi, which is southeast of Jackson, Mississippi. He was a smart kid, but uneven grades in school, and his father had to pull a lobby to get him admitted into UVA, where he excelled as a track star. In fact, at one point considered joining the Olympic team. He earned top honors at UVA Law School and then made his way to New York City, where he joined a venerable Wall Street law firm, one of whose early members was Franklin Roosevelt at one point. Wisner was soon handling top cases there, but he became bored silly with law work. War was looming on the horizon. Wisner took a trip to Germany in 1938 and could see plainly that Adolf Hitler represented a future threat, and he wanted to be in on the action on what he envisioned was a second world war, World War II. So 5 months before Pearl Harbor, he joined the Navy as a lieutenant junior grade, ended up being just as bored with the work he was assigned to do, which was in a small, obscure naval intelligence unit in New York City. He joked to his kids that he once commanded a cutter, but the cutter actually was a pair of scissors clipping out news files. Then he heard something about this shadowy organization called the OSS, run by Wild Bill Donovan. Wisner had socialized with Donovan in New York. Donovan was a prominent New York attorney, and so he knew him. And eventually applied to Donovan's outfit. Donovan's organization was authorized, set up by Franklin Roosevelt, who did not have any type of formal foreign intelligence service in Europe. And in fact, the lack of intelligence he had on what was going on in Europe at that time literally made him physically ill at times, because he was making major decisions like lend-lease aid, not knowing what was ahead. So he allowed Donovan, even though Donovan was a prominent Republican, the Democrats in the White House were all worried about Franklin's pick here, to set up this OSS. Donovan recruited the really America's best and brightest for his organization. He also recruited a number of people with specialized skills like lock picks, forgers, race car drivers, big time athletes. Wisner kind of checked all the right boxes for him because he was a military man, fit and trim as he neared his mid-30s. He wasn't from an Ivy League school. Donovan placed high value in that, but he had worked in Donovan's home turf on Wall Street. And so in 1943, Wisner boarded a bus from Washington's Union Station to Towson, Maryland, where he spent 2 weeks learning to be a spy.
Get us to Romania.
Okay.
And what he does there and why it's so important in his career.
He keep in mind, he had very, very little spy training, and a lot of them didn't. He wasn't qualified enough as a spy to actually work in the field. He'd need a lot more training with that. But he was qualified enough to run an operation that the OSS had in mind for him at the agency's station in Cairo. And that was basically to oversee, organize, and process the intelligence reports coming in from stations all over the Middle East, Central Asia, and the Balkans that the Cairo station oversaw. Wisner did a very good job of that. From there, he was awarded a position that he really didn't want, which was to fly into Istanbul, Turkey, and clean up what had become a mess of an operation there. It was run by an old savings and loan executive from Illinois, an old Republican pal of Donovan's named Lanning Packy McFarland, who was a big talker and had grand plans about organizing espionage operations into the Balkans. Turns out, though, Packy was horrible on tradecraft. He was terrible on security. In fact, the first time Wisner met him was in an Istanbul nightclub, dimly lit, where he thought they were going to have a somewhat private meeting. But all of a sudden, lights shine onto a stage. The curtain opens. Out dances a line of Turkish chorus girls. And Packy is in the middle of that line, dressed in drag, kicking as high as he could and singing, "Boo Boo Baby, I'm a Spy." I'm not making this up.
Not great spycraft.
Not very good spycraft.
Right.
They sent Packy home. It took Wisner several months to clean up the Istanbul mess. And then he talked Donovan into letting him go on the offensive and go fly into Romania to set up an intelligence operation there. Now, keep in mind, at this point, Romania was an ally of Nazi Germany, but it could see which way the war was running, and it wasn't running in the Germans' direction. And so the Romanians wanted to switch sides, and they started cultivating the Soviets, British, and the Americans. Wisner flies in a hijacked Luftwaffe transport plane that a Romanian pilot got a hold of, and flew from Istanbul to Bucharest, Romania, where he set up basically the beginning, an entire full-scale intelligence operation there. Eventually had more than 20 people working under him. And they were doing all kinds of things like rescuing downed Allied pilots who'd been shot down over Romania, gathering up Nazi documents, military and intelligence. In fact, they literally scooped up 1 ton worth of documents. And what became more important, they started spying on the Red Army, which was moving into the into the city. They set up headquarters in a beer magnate's mansion, big mansion, and the beer tycoon's wife was the beautiful Alexandra Tanda Caragia, who was an official Romanian princess. And Tanda showed Wisner ushered him into Romanian society, into government and political circles. It was very, very helpful with his intelligence collection. The two, however, soon had an affair. And it was a wartime fling for Wisner. He never thought about divorcing his wife at home, Polly Knowles Wisner. And, that was it. But it came back to haunt him much later when he was in Washington. And J. Edgar Hoover got wind, learned of the affair, and Wisner's enemies started spreading the rumor that Tanda had worked for the communists at Soviets that supplied them information. And Wisner knew he was sleeping with a communist agent.
Was she a communist agent?
Well, yeah, she was. But the CIA did a lot of investigating. They turned that whole case upside down, looking for any evidence that Wisner knew of Tanda's secret connection with the Soviets. And it turned out he didn't, from what they could tell. And they closed the case. J. Edgar Hoover, though, was kind of like a dog with a choice bone. He wasn't going to let this go. And he never did. And Wisner, for the rest of his life, literally was always looking over his shoulder for Hoover. And at one point in the 50s, for Joe McCarthy to find out about this and expose it and, basically sink his career.
Right. And, what's so interesting about this is, a common theme of the history of the Cold War in the United States was the tension between Hoover's FBI and the CIA. They were constantly battling each other in bureaucratic wars. And this became something that Hoover glommed onto to stick it to the CIA and continue to investigate at the highest levels of the CIA. When we get to the Cold War, the end of World War II, Wisner, like most of the U.S. national security establishment, is ardently anti-Soviet, in part. This was interesting in your book, in part because of what he observed in Romania, what the Russians were doing in Romania.
Wisner came home from World War II basically, invigorated by his experience in World War II. He thought that would be the most exciting time of his life when he was over there. He also came home with a deep-seated bitterness toward the Soviet Union, because particularly from what he witnessed in Romania, where the Soviets loaded some 90,000 ethnic Germans in Romania and shipped them off to slave labor camps in Russia to work in the Russian mines. Wisner tried to save a few, but couldn't really do it. The Soviets, in the meantime, Soviet generals soon began to sniff out Wisner's operation in Romania and could tell he was doing more than just, fighting the Germans there, that he was spying on them. And so they put pressure on the American occupation force that moved into Romania to shrink his program. Basically, they wanted to get him out of there. Right. And he left, but he left deeply embittered toward the Soviets, and warned Washington before Washington was really prepared to hear it that the Soviet Union was going to be America's next enemy, going to replace the Germans as America's next enemy.
Right. And he gets selected to head this nebulous body. Frankly, I had not even, don't even remember hearing about the Office of Policy Coordination that in those early days, this is under the Truman administration, was running covert ops against the Soviets, entirely separate from the CIA, which had just been created.
It was. And then we're talking about the late 1940s. Truman's National Security Council set up, authorized this program with the enthusiastic backing of the State Department. And it was called, it was known as OPC, Office of Policy Coordination, a bland sounding name, but it had a huge and important covert mission, which was to mount clandestine operations, propaganda, psy war operations against the Soviets, infiltrate agents into Eastern Europe, and fight with dirty tactics like Moscow did. And Wisner was basically given a blank check to operate on his own. He operated outside of the CIA because the CIA early CIA director at that time, Admiral Roscoe Hillenkoetter, really didn't wasn't enthusiastic about covert operations for his people. He'd rather have them be pure spies, intelligence collectors. And so they gave this job to Wisner, who set up his shop in a bunch of dilapidated World War II barracks along the Reflecting Pool in Washington. In fact, they nicknamed it the Rat Palace because they had to share the their quarters with the rodents that infested it. Wisner kind of worked, he actually kind of hornswoggled Hillenkoetter into agreeing to an arrangement where Wisner would tell Hillenkoetter about the major projects he was doing from time to time, basically. But Wisner got to pick what projects were major and what weren't. So he had a loophole there big enough to drive a truck through. And he was able to operate on his own.
Right. And one of those projects of which Wisner seemed particularly obsessed was Albania, trying to infiltrate, drop guerrillas into Albania to overthrow the communist regime of Hoxha. And it was a complete, if I read your book correctly, fiasco that produced nothing.
It was. And what Albania showed, this was Project BG Fiend. The British worked with the Americans on this particular project. It was a joint operation. And the goal of it was to infiltrate Albanian agents into what was an impoverished communist satellite country. In the East Bloc. I mean, it was in really bad shape. But what Albania showed was that you could have even a rundown country economically and still have a very skilled intelligence and counterintelligence service, which the Albanians had. So, the operational security was not all that great for who they sent in. The agents were not particularly well trained. In fact, the British were kind of snobby about it. They called the Albanian agents pixies because they were small and kind of disheveled looking. Really wasn't a very flattering name for them. But anyway, the teams that the British sent in and the Americans sent in, the Albanian security service had no problem rounding them up, killing off a lot of them and chasing the others into Greece. Out of the country.
And with some help by a senior British intelligence officer who was actually a mole for the Kremlin.
That was Kim Philby,
yes.
Who was head of the British intelligence in the British Embassy in Washington, a standout British agent. The only problem was he was also a standout KGB agent. He used to joke that he was the only two that got medals of honor from both sides for the work he did. Philby, kept the KGB apprised of what was happening in Albania. The interesting thing, though, is when I talked to some Albanian historians that have gone through a lot of the records and everything. The KGB actually didn't part with all that much information to the Albanians about Wisner's operation there. They didn't want to blow Kilby's cover. And also, the Albanian security service were doing spectacularly well on their own, rounding up the Albanian agents that were infiltrated in. Mm-hmm. So it was only a marginal effect. But Philby, of course, had huge impact on other operations. Wisner started wondering why a lot of them were failing so miserably, and he started suspecting that it must be somebody, some mole, some leak out of this whole operation, either in the British or his own operation, his own U.S. operation.
Right. Well, look, the Albania story is a really fascinating one, but I want to take a quick break now. And when we come back, talk about what may have been the most controversial of all of Wisner's CIA covert ops, overthrowing the governments of Iran in 1953. And then Guatemala the following year. So let's take a quick break. We'll be back with Doug in a moment. Okay, we are back with Doug Waller, a veteran national security reporter who has written this new book, The Determined Spy, a biography of Frank Wisner. And let's get to the covert op that still reverberates throughout the Mideast today. And that's the fateful decision by the CIA, under Wisner and his boss, Alan Dulles, to overthrow the government of Iran in 1953. Why did they do it? What was the basis for it? And how did it come about?
When Eisenhower became president in 1953, he and John Foster Dulles, his Secretary of State, and Alan Dulles, Foster's brother and director of the CIA, believe that they could see that the CIA and Wisner's operation, clandestine service, was making no headway in infiltrating East Bloc countries under direct Soviet rule. So they switched targets. They redirected the CIA clandestine operations toward third world nations, particularly in Latin America, the Middle East, and Southeast Asia. The goal there was to blunt and roll back communist incursions into those regions. The second thing that Eisenhower and Foster Dulles were intent on was they didn't tolerate neutrals, third world leaders who didn't really want to have much to do with either the Soviet bloc or the Western bloc, and who wanted to remain independent. In this period, neutrals weren't allowed. You were either for the United States or against it. There were no in-betweeners that were permitted. The first test case became Iran. Which was whose popularly elected leader, Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, was a Cold War neutral who moved quickly to nationalize Iran's war oil production facility to take it back from British control, and who was willing to tolerate a small communist minority in his country. Mossadegh was also kind of an oddball, too. He liked to pretend to faint at times, pass out. Other times he would hold important government meetings in his bedroom, just wearing his gray pajamas. But Mossadegh soon made some big enemies. First off, the country's military hierarchy and its monarchists, who backed the Shah of Iran. Number two, the British, who wanted their oil back, or what they believed was their oil. And number three, Dwight Eisenhower, the Dulles brothers, and Frank Wisner, who feared that the Russians to the north were at the doorstep ready to invade Iran and take over the country.
Were they?
No, not really. And it was interesting, the analytical wing in the CIA was cautioning that, well, don't get too worried about this. They were recommending, we ought to cultivate Mossadegh and win him to our side with economic aid and diplomacy. But Wisner and Alan Dulles and John Foster Dulles weren't listening to that. Again, you were either for the Washington or you were against it.
This is another case of U.S. officials at the highest levels acting on faulty intelligence to get involved in overthrowing a government in the Mideast.
Yeah. Basically, it was
something would be repeated in years to come.
Yeah. History repeats itself. That's for sure.
Yeah.
So they sent in Kermit Roosevelt, who was a grandson of President Theodore Roosevelt, and basically he helped along the forces already in the country that were aligned against Mossadegh. Mossadegh was overthrown, and the Shah was put into power. 1 year later, the next kind of neutral third world leader, Jacobo Arbenz of Guatemala, the young 37-year-old president of Guatemala, came under the crosshairs of Washington. Arbenz was a government reformer, was some of the reforms, the United Fruit Company, which was a Boston-based company that owned, was the largest landholder in Guatemala, harvesting bananas and exporting them, didn't like. The Dulles brothers and Wisner were convinced that the Russians were on the doorstep here. Arbenz had kind of flirted with, you know, communist ideology. He and his beautiful Salvadoran wife had studied communism quite a bit, but realized that their country wasn't ready for that drastic a change. But in the eyes of Washington, Arbenz had to go, and Wisner, was kind of unusual back then, took really personal control over the coup plotting effort to oust Arbenz. He made a lot of the day-to-day decisions, which was, you know, for a guy who was commanding 6,000 operatives around the world, to zero in on one was a huge amount of his time. And they did. They ousted Arbenz.
That was a case of the CIA training guerrillas to invade and topple a government in Latin America, something that would be repeated some years later with not as much success. I'm talking, of course, about the Bay of Pigs. But I want to go back to Iran for a moment because there's a personal side for you in this that absolutely fascinated me. And that's the role of a guy I never heard of before reading your book. And that is John Waller. Who was a top CIA guy, head of the Iran branch of covert ops for CIA, a top deputy to Wisner. And you thought the two of you might be related. And you thought that could help you, that might unlock some secrets about what your presumed cousin John Waller was up to. Tell us that story.
Well, yeah, it turns out that John Waller was kind of an unsung intellectual force behind the Iran coup effort.
You call him the brains of the operation. In the
he
book.
Really was. Kermit Roosevelt got all the credit because he wrote a book about his exploits there, and that's what everybody had to go on. But when you read the documents, the CIA documents that have been declassified, and there are thousands of them, the pages that have been declassified, you see that John Waller was the intellectual brainchild behind the operation, putting together, you know, the strategic effort and everything. And Wisner really relied on him heavily and thought in some respects more highly of him than he did of Kermit Roosevelt. We are probably, John Waller and I are probably related. I never actually explored it, but it's an unusual sounding last name. And I can remember when I was with Newsweek magazine as a correspondent and John Waller just left the CIA. He had been the inspector general of the agency at one point, and then was involved heavily in the Association of Former Intelligence Officers. And I called him up one day and say, "Hey, cousin," hoping that, you know, he'd be forthcoming on it. I've forgotten what the story was. And it turned out he wasn't. He said, yeah, he says, that won't work.
Did he say that? That won't work?
Well, not in so many words, but because he was much more polite about it. When you're interviewing, as you know, Mike, when you're interviewing CIA clandestine officers, they can be very, very charming, very, very, very loquacious, but not tell you anything you really needed.
Right, and not tell you nothing. So some of the seedier details of the coup that your presumed cousin helped orchestrate for Frank Wisner, bribing opposition leaders, stirring up street demonstrations, hiring street thugs to attack religious clerics, and then blame it on Mossadegh to sort of stir up popular opposition. It was, not exactly one of the kind of glorified moments the CIA would like to advertise the kind of stuff it was doing. But the net result was the overthrow of the government of Iran. What really struck me, though, about your book, and I didn't realize this, is nobody knew about the CIA's role in doing this at the time. Eisenhower wrote about it in his book, Mandate for Change, never mentioning that the CIA had played a hand, had a big hand in overthrowing the Iran government. No members of Congress were briefed on it. Journalists never wrote about it, even though some, like Joe Alsop, a friend of Wisner's, knew all about it. It's pretty stunning.
Yeah, it doesn't even qualify for a conspiracy of silence because there were so many people that, you know, basically kept quiet about it. Alan Dulles may have tipped off a few senior members of Congress because at this point, you know, Congress, particularly in Iran and Guatemala, was pressuring the administration to do something in those countries. And I think Alan Dulles probably told some senior members, well, we're going to get this problem taken care of. But no, not the how and what were all kept secret. And as you say, what I thought was interesting was the press. There were reporters who knew about the CIA's role in both Iran and Guatemala, their view was, well, the business of journalism is not to get into the affairs of government and dictate who we overthrow and who we don't overthrow. It's kind of it was a logic of its time that probably, wouldn't pass muster today, I hope.
Right, right.
And it's too bad, too, if I can mention it. I mean, it's the long-term implications of these two operations were really disastrous for both. The Shah turned out to be a corrupt and autocrat and was eventually overthrown by Islamic fundamentalists in 1979. And Iran became a base camp for terrorism abroad, which still exists today. In Guatemala, Arbenz was succeeded by a whole string of brutal military dictators who ended up death squads killing 200,000 Guatemalan peasants and disappearing 40,000 more. But back then, 1953 and 54, Dwight Eisenhower was absolutely delighted with these two operations because here he had thwarted Moscow in what was considered two hotbeds for communism without having to send in a single Marine or a military tank, which would have cost a huge amount of money. These covert operations are pretty cheap. It doesn't cost much to get them underway.
But you say the long-term impact was disastrous. And I mean, in Iran to this day, supporters of the regime, the mullahs, will talk about what the CIA did back in 1953. So this is still reverberating throughout the region. By the way, your namesake, John Waller, I found an obituary for him in the Washington Post. No mention at all of his role in Iran. He wrote a number of books, historical books, but did he ever write or talk about what he did in to overthrow the government of Iran?
Not that I saw. And the first time I saw it was in the declassified papers that the CIA has released. And the CIA has released tens of thousands of documents on both the Iran and the Guatemalan operation.
Yeah. Well, we should wrap up by talking about what ultimately happened to Frank Wisner, because that became part of the legend of the CIA. He was a brilliant man, but a troubled man, and suffered from, as you write, bipolar disorder, which led to him being committed to a mental institution.
It did. I mean, this was his other enemy, and it was inside his own body. The big question, it was a mystery how he got bipolar disorder, which back then was called manic depression, because it combines the frenzy of mania with the absolute misery of depression. It's a very, very cruel disease, and a mysterious disease in many ways, even to this day. There was some speculation that Wisner may have inherited it from his mother, who the family believed suffered from depression, although it was never clinically diagnosed in her. Wisner was somewhat hyperactive as a child, but that was kind of passed off to just being a busy kid. World War II comrades thought that, you know, Wisner went overboard in his hatred of the Russians, but he had an awful lot to hate in what he saw in Romania and also occupied Germany. When he came to Washington, Wisner had one of the symptoms he had is what psychiatrists call hypomania, which is excess energy, creativity, a level of charisma. But this describes, you know, half of official Washington as, you know, valuable attributes. So that really didn't stand out. It was in the mid-1950s that Wisner started to lose his cool. He burst out in complaints and meetings, complaining about being overworked and having so many operations out there. Kind of ironic, because he was the one who was launching these operations. He started to believe that people were out to get him. He started snapping at people more. He started drinking more heavily and smoking more. But friends thought, well, that's, you know, this is Frank in a pressure cooker job. He's just blowing off steam here. It was the end of 1956, fall 1956, when he that the genetic time bomb in him detonated. He was in Europe. Russian tanks moved into Hungary and in the Middle East. The British and the French, with the help of the Israelis, launched a military operation to seize the Suez Canal, which Nasser had taken over. Wisner became frantic, started going from one CIA station to another, ranting and raving, micromanaging what they were doing, sending back dispatches to Washington that nobody could understand, staying up till 5 a.m. every night, working and getting up early the next day. Colleagues in the stations believed that he was having a nervous breakdown, which in effect he was. Mm-hmm. He comes back, though, to the United States. The manic depression subsides for a while. He seems to be back to normal and everything. But then it comes back to haunt him again, so that at the end of 1958, his wife Polly, along with some friends, finally talk him into going into a mental institution near Boston, near Baltimore, called the Shepherd Pratt Institute, which was a first class institute back then, and still is to this day. He spent 172 days there. Was given shock therapy, which actually worked for him. Shock therapy was a very successful treatment. It's successful to this day, but it's only temporary.
There's a line in your book that really leapt out at me. Eisenhower, during this period, had set up something called the Board of Consultants on Foreign Intelligence Activities, which were sort of, you know, wise graybeards who were supposed to advise the White House about what was going on in the CIA. The board told Ike bluntly that it was dangerous entrusting so much power over American foreign policy to a man now found to be insane.
Yeah. I mean, this had huge implications, particularly when he checked into Shepard Pratt for U.S. foreign policy and covert policy. I mean, reports, I mean, it was kept secret, or they tried to keep his commitment secret. But this spread around in official Washington. I mean, it spread all over. The FBI was apprised of it. The White House was kept close track of the you know, what was happening to Wisner, because this was a major major development.
Right.
Now, when he finally left, when he left the Shepard Pratt Institute. The CIA actually took an enlightened view of officers who suffered from alcoholism or mental issues. They wanted to get them help and get them back to work. They considered these ailments battle casualties. In Wisner's case, though, there was no chance he was going to move back into the huge job of heading up the clandestine service. So they sent him to as the station chief for London, where it was largely a diplomatic posting, and one he did well at, until the manic depression returned, and then he had to return back to the U.S. and he resigned in 1962. Then worked as a consultant for a while, but again he couldn't shake off this awful disease.
And he takes his own life in 1965.
He does on
shoots himself. Yeah.
October 29th, 1965. He was at the farm he owned in Galena, near Galena, Maryland, on the Eastern Shore, and in his farmhouse. And up on the second floor, he found a Belgian Browning double-barreled shotgun and pointed it at his right temple. And fired it and killed himself instantly. He was only 56 years old.
Wow.
I mean, for a pioneer, right, for the agency, it was a tragic way to go.
And there's a pointed side to this, or, you know, a personal side to it. His wife, Polly Wisner, big socialite in Washington, Georgetown socialite, best friends of Catherine Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post, whose husband, Phil Graham, had shot himself and killed himself as well. And Phil Graham and Frank Wisner were best buddies as well.
And more, Polly and Catherine Graham became the closest of friends.
Right.
And, you know, they were part of what was called the Georgetown set back then. These were... Yeah. Young, up-and-coming leaders in the media and government who got together for Sunday suppers regularly.
Right. What should be the takeaway from this book? What's your takeaway from this?
This is a story of a man who really pioneered the modern U.S. Introduction into secret political warfare. You know, he was the founding father of the CIA's clandestine service. He also pioneered the CIA's entry into what's called liaison relationships. That's where the CIA works with other foreign intelligence services. And it really gives the CIA a world-class reach. And a broad reach, you know, all over the globe, which, you know, is, you know, one of the things that defines us really as a superpower in many ways. But he had a batting average, okay? I mean, a lot of hits, but a lot of strikes and strikeouts, which is the way, you know, intelligence operations tend to run back then and today.
So what was his batting average?
Oh boy, I, you know, It was probably better than what a big leaguer has right now. You keep a, you know, a big leaguer who strikes out 7 out of 10 times is a star. I don't know.
I mean, I don't. How do you count Iran? How do you count Guatemala? You could count it as a hit or a home run at first, but then long run, it proved, as you pointed out, disastrous. Yeah. And you put that on top of Albania and all the other failed operations in Eastern Europe. I'm not sure. He didn't look like a 300 hitter to me after reading your book.
He did. In fairness to Wisner, he did do on his propaganda things, or at least the Russians were furious over it. You know, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, which were all CIA operations or funded operations. You know, the Russians went bananas over it. I don't know how much they had really to worry about, but it did. But yeah, you know, you look like, for example, in Asia, Edward Lansdale, who headed up the counterinsurgency operation in the Philippines to battle the Huk guerrillas, did very, very well there.
Once he was transferred to Vietnam.
Exactly.
Another Wisner-supported operation.
Yeah, exactly. And the people they sent over for trying to infiltrate China and North Korea all failed pretty miserably, too.
So is there a lesson in all of this for today?
Yeah. Be damn careful what you jump into. A, you might not get what you wanted. B, you may get what you wanted, both of which are not good. That's the old Colin Powell dictum.
Right. Yeah.
And it's true. I mean, Eisenhower liked these covert operations, A, because, you know, he didn't have to expend a lot of money doing them. He also didn't have to brief Congress about it. You know, it was all done in secret. So he didn't have to go through all the hoops and hurdles of debate for, you know, whether what he was doing was correct. That's all good. But sometimes that debate's really necessary until somebody stands up and says, this isn't going to work out. And if it does, it's not something we want.
Would a modern day Wisner now be trying to overthrow the governments of Denmark, Panama, Canada?
I don't think so. I think that's a White House operation right now.
Okay. Well, we can go back to the Office of Policy Coordination.
There you go.
Which was run out of the White House. Anyway, Doug Waller, it's a fascinating book, a fascinating subject. The Determined Spy, The Turbulent Life and Times of CIA Pioneer Frank Wisner. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archives on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. MSW Media.
It's Sunday morning, and that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you.